Mr. Roth, Reel 8. Now, we were talking about your time based with the bulk of the regiment at Famagusta. And what about these night patrols? I mean, you've covered the daytime, but what were you doing in the evening?
Well, the night patrols, we used to call them soft shoe patrols. I don't actually remember doing these out of Famagusta, but we certainly did them out of Bogaz. And then when we moved to another camp further up the panhandle at Arcrades. And as I said, you know, flying Greek flags was illegal, painting slogans was illegal, and we used to go out, and it was usually just three of you, a second lieutenant and a couple of gunners, wearing dark brown plimsolls, all dark clothes, black in your face, so that you were, and you would endeavour, and I use endeavour advisedly for reasons I will explain in a moment, you endeavoured to get into the village unobserved, lie up, and the theory was that your fellow comes out and starts hauling up his little Greek flag and you leap out and arrest him. I have to say, I never actually managed to arrest anybody, but
no, I mean,
it did happen.
These patrols, to me, sound like the present making yourself incredibly vulnerable.
Yes.
Yes. They were covert. You were
absolutely.
Well, you were not disguised, but you were difficult to see. Mm. But if you were seen, then there were three of you. You sound very vulnerable to me.
I absolutely agree. And looking back on it now, I think we were amazingly vulnerable. But one of the things was that they weren't all that often very successful, and the whole problem was dogs. Because this sounds slightly silly, but it's absolutely true. You'd be creeping in, you'd try and creep into this village, and you might be creeping across back gardens or something. Obviously, you're not going down the road. And if you turned up one dog and he started barking, the whole village full of dogs started barking. And that was it, of course. You were blown. And I'm quite convinced, and never actually caught somebody, but I'm quite convinced that the soldiers generally used to wait to see the first possible dog and then chuck an illicit little stone at him to get him going, because that was the end of the patrol, you see. And then
you'd pull out.
Oh, yes, there was no point going on, because the village would know then that there were intruders in the village. And I swear that the soldiers, and I have to say, if I'd been a soldier, I think I would have done it too. But there was the famous night in the cemetery.
Which cemetery? No.
This is, oh God, one of the villages. I can't remember. But I know that I'd worked it out that if you could get to the cemetery, which alongside the church, you could then get into, and they have a nice observation of the village square. And we actually got to the edge of the cemetery, and I climb over this little wall and jump down 3 feet into the cemetery. And the two gunners are coming down beside me. One of them, and I remember with great clarity, his name was Kilmartin, because as I landed, I suddenly realized there was this tomb with a shaft of light coming out of it, which seriously frightened me. And even more frightened Gunner Kilmartin, because he just said, Jesus Christ, and grabbed me. And sort of, and what it turned out to be was that there was a practice in Cyprus. They used to have little, gosh, what would you call them? Catafalque, would that be the word? On top of a tomb. And they used to put a candle inside. And as I say, of course, all we see is a shaft of light coming out of a tomb. And of course, you're very tense anyway. I mean, you're creeping into a basically hostile village, playing at being soldiers, you know. And then that, and I dare him, poor old Kilmartin, I think it aged him about 5 years.
Any other incidents on these night patrols then? I understand some of these were from while you were at the earlier camp, and that's fine. But
another subaltern told the story, and I've no reason to doubt the truth of this. And he was called Sandy Attio, A-T-Y-E-O. And he was doing one of these, and he was going across the bottom of the garden. And suddenly the back door opened, and of course they all froze. I mean, they're all on the ground, and he freezes. And he said this girl came down, hoiked up her skirts, dropped her drawers, and peed. And he reckoned that he was so close to her that he could have actually put out his hand and touched her. And he said, you know, he said the temptation was quite high. He said, but then I thought, by and large, it was not a good thing to do. But apparently that actually happened. And he said it really was quite amazing. And she then gets up and hoinks off her drawers and goes back into the house and never realized that she was within about 2 feet of a soldier. But I never caught anybody. They used to. They used to every now and again kept some poor beggar hoisting a flag or painting a slogan on the road, you know, and then he'd be hauled up in the courts and I don't know what the punishment was. But I personally never caught anybody.
So what next then? You're based at Famagusta.
Yeah, well then the...
Were there ever any serious demonstrations in Famagusta? Yeah.
Not in Famagusta, but we had a seriously bad day on the 28th of October.
Now where was that at?
That was in a town called Trichomo.
Did you move there then, or were you still
operating? No, Trichomo was part of our area. And
you were still based at Famagusta?
Yes, regiments.
Oh, well, tell us about this then. What exactly happened?
Well, the 28th of October is called Occhi Day. I think it's spelled O-C-H-I. And it's all to do, it's sort of celebration of their national hero, Metexas. You heard of Metexas? Well, I'm not too clear exactly what he did, but he basically liberated Greece from the Turks. And he's a great sort of national Greek hero. And the 28th of October is the day on which they celebrate, I suppose a bit like our Trafalgar Day, only more so. And it was anticipated there would be a lot of trouble. Now, why
in Trichomo? Why not in Famagusta?
Trichomo, as far as I'm concerned, because that's where the riot squad of which I was part was sent.
Right, okay? sorry. Yeah.
Because Trichomo is part of our regimental area.
So they'd be covering all these major centres, and this just happened to be where you were.
And we, because we were about 30 strong, we were a full-blown riot squad. That's, shields and pickhounds and flag carriers and tear gas boys, you know. Do you know the formation?
No, could you describe
that? Oh, well, a riot squad is you have the first rank, you have about eight, I suppose you vary the size depending upon what you're coping with, but ours, I seem to remember, used to be eight. The front rank, and there was eight soldiers. They had shields, and they had pickhells. And they were the front rank, and they could, a bit like the old Roman legions, you know, they could all stand there with shields and kind of present a sort of wall. Behind that, you had two fellows with a big banner, which I can't remember, what did it used to say now? Disperse, I think, in Greek and in Turkish. And they were the banner men. And you had a couple of soldiers equipped with tear gas.
Tear gas what?
Grenades. Tear gas grenades. You had...
They were thrown grenades, launched. Yeah.
No, hand grenades. canisters, really. Canisters. You had a couple of marksmen, theoretically selected because they were very good shots, because the theory was if you were the riot squad commander and you decided that the chap in the red jacket over towards the left was the one who was really, and you decided the time had come when he should be shot, you would say to your marksman, man in the red jacket, you know, 11 o'clock, shoot, you see. I never got to that stage as far as I'm concerned, but I mean, that was the theory. There were others. There was two soldiers with a stretcher, and there were a few others, and I can't remember now what specifically if they had any or whether they were just sort of make weight. But you were talking about something like between 20 and 30 men. Now, on this particular day...
And you were in command of this one?
No, I was second in command because there was a full lieutenant called Peter Gill. He was the senior there, and I was the second in command. And we were slightly bigger than average, and we were sent out to this town called Trichomo. and our brief was, to really, to keep the peace.
And were you expecting this Metaxo demonstration?
It was expected that the island basically... Oh, yes, because it was known. Oki Day is quite famous. It was anticipated that there would be a lot of anti-Brit demonstrations. Well, we arrive in Trichomoe. Now, Trichomoe is on the crossroads. If you can think of Cyprus, you have Nicosia in the middle and the Panhandle, and you have the main road from Nicosia, all Rizokapatso is the name of the place at the head of the Panhandle. Just come back to it. You have the main road from Nicosia right up the long thin bit, and then you have the main road from Famagusta going up to somewhere north of the Kyrenia Mountains, and I can't remember the name of that at the moment, but it'll come back to me. And Trichomoe is on the crossroads. It was also the birthplace of Colonel Grievous, which made it a little bit more sensitive, perhaps, than a lot of other places. Anyway, Peter Gill and myself arrived with our 30-odd soldiers and a couple of trucks. And we stationed ourselves in an orange grove just on the edge of the square. And we suddenly then see a procession beginning to form up. And you clearly have the mayor, or the Mukhtar, as I think was the official title, the Mukhtar. And that, and they were beginning to form up, and they had Greek flags. Now, this was, strictly speaking, illegal. and you're not supposed to do it. But Peter Gill and I looked at each other and said, we have got 28 soldiers. Trichomoe is a town, 3,000-4,000 population. What can we do, realistically? And so we decided that we would, providing they didn't do anything too excessive, we let them go off to church, sing their few hymns, disperse to lunch. And we reckoned that, all right, so they'd have their illegal procession, but not a lot of damage. And anyway, what could we do with 28 soldiers? Sadly, at that moment, a senior major, who was second in command of the regiment, called Camel, known to all the subalterns as the Hump, one of the, I thought, unpleasant senior officers. I never liked him particularly. I thought he I thought he was arrogant. I thought he was a classic bull-headed, bone-headed soldier. He arrives, starts waving his arms and saying, Peter, John, look, you know, they're all forming up. You've got to stop it. You know, this is absolutely not allowed. So with great reluctance, Peter and I bring our soldiers out of the orange grove and we start to form up. And I remember this, because I've never forgotten it. The priest, the papa, you know, the Macarius with the black. And I saw him peel away from the head of the procession. And I saw him start, he went up a little road leading, going up the hill. It was a sort of narrow street. And I saw him going up there, and I remember saying to Peter Gill, I said, Peter, the riot will come out of that street in the next couple of minutes. And that's exactly what happened. It was, they were waiting for us to do exactly what the Major Camel said. Go and try and stop the procession. And they were waiting, and they had rent a mob up the street. And 2 minutes later, they came down, woof.
Now, so it's your belief that the priest was going to lead them, or at least to direct
them? He went to get them. Went to get them. And I saw him peel away from the head of the procession, go up. And I knew instantly, and I said to Peter, that's where the riot will come from. And he did, you know, 2 minutes later, instant. All sort of youth, you know, all the 16, 17, 18-year-olds, armed with rocks and you name it. And then there was a full-blown punch-up. Major Camel leaps into his Land Rover and announces he will go for reinforcements. Roars off out of the village.
Now, what exactly happened in this punch-up? I mean, can you describe what happened?
Well, as soon as the scale of the riot became apparent to Peter Gill and myself, we decided that what we would do, we would retreat on the police station. Now, I should explain that the police stations at towns like Trichomoe were mini fortresses. Sandbagged, barbed wire, enclosures, fixed-line Bren guns, they were little mini-fortresses with a permanent guard in it. We retreated back towards that, and we then had the benefit of a road.
Now, there was no question of maintaining your position by using, the tear gas or the staves or the pickaxe.
What position was there to maintain? I mean, you just have now a great big mob coming at you.
How many, roughly? I mean, it's difficult to count.
200. 200 to 300.
And this is separate from the main procession, is it?
Oh yes, this is all young.
So the main procession still continues.
Well, the procession by this time is all fragmented. The procession never actually moved off. This was before procession even moved off, and that sort of dissolves now. The procession kind of dissolves and turns into a riot. And
what were they? Were they throwing stones, or were they in any way attacking you?
Oh, rocks. We ended up with 8 of our 30 injured, and we formed up on this road, and then we had the shield men out in front and so forth, and we just held the line. We didn't try to do anything, but you see what they did. they put the women and the children at the front.
Hang on, so you retreated to the police station, but you didn't go into it. You just
no, we stopped short of it.
So why didn't you go into it?
That's a very good question, and I'm trying to think why we didn't.
I presume it would have been Peter Geld, Peter's decision.
Yeah, but I honestly can't remember now, but I know we formed up across the road, but you see, they put the women and the children at the front, and all the obs, all the lads with their rocks and that are behind the women and the children. And they're chucking the stones and whatever. And we're just standing there with these all sort of pelting down around you.
Now, was there any question of retaliating, either with, in any way, or opening fire? I mean, you could have opened fire.
Yes, we could. But, I mean, it was well short of that kind of situation.
How would you define that kind of situation? How much worse would it get before you'd open fire?
Well, yes, that's a good question.
I mean, your men being injured, you know, they're you're under attack. They're not shooting at you, are they?
They're not shooting. They're just chucking rocks. And I mean, all I can say is that I don't think it occurred to either Peter Gill or myself that we had reached a sort of shooting situation. The problem was compounded because what we were confronted with was a lot of women and children. And we decided that unless the situation deteriorated more, we would just simply hold the line and await developments. And in fact, what happened was that Major Camel had gone off, and the next thing that happens is that a detachment of the Turkish Mobile Reserve, which were special police, and they were all Turkish, come in. And they came in into the back of the riot, and I mean they were totally brutal. They just went straight in, women, children, and I actually saw one Turkish policeman pick up a small child, 2-year-old, and throw him through a window, closed window. I hasten to add, but they were, and of course they were Turks, you see, and this is all Greek, so you have all the angst and so forth. But that broke it up, and then we then we went on the move, and we started to break it all up then,
Did your front row be using their pickaxe helms?
Yeah, yes, they were now. Oh, yes, now. And it was kind of running battle, but the idea now was to try and disperse it all. But the most extraordinary thing, and it sounds ludicrous, but I can tell you it's deeply frightening. At some point, we were going down a narrow street, and somebody threw an easy chair out of an upstairs window onto us. Now, I know it sounds ludicrous, but I can tell you, an easy chair coming down from the first floor is quite formidable. anyway, the consequence was that we sort of broke it up, and more soldiers come pouring in from all directions and so forth. Then they made an amazing decision. They decided to seal up the town. Totally. And this developed into a most extraordinary scenario because this town is sealed up. There's roadblocks on each of the four roads. Nobody allowed to move in and out without written permission. signed either by myself or by Peter Gill, who are left in charge of this, and we blockaded that town for 5 days.
And were you just back to your original 30 or so, or did you?
Oh, no. We had a lot of soldiers now, and we had, as I say, we had roadblocks.
But you were in charge.
Well, Peter Gill was, yes.
He
was in charge. And we were just told that nobody went in and out of the village until they painted out all the slogans, took down all the flags, and sort of cleaned the place up. And it was a great standoff for about 3 days. I remember we sort of sat in the police station, which was our headquarters, playing endless gin rummy, I seem to remember. But you had this endless succession of Greeks turning up, all wanting a pass to get out of. They all had myriad reasons, none of which we would accept, and we just said no, no, no. And then came the moment when the man appeared and said that his wife had gone into labour, and he had to take her down to Famagusta. The fact that he proposed to use a lorry full of melons didn't, as far as he was concerned, was neither here nor there. But we decided, Peter and I decided, yeah, that's a bit of a ploy. So we rang up Tom Duncan, the regimental doctor, and said to him, how would you like to come up and deliver a baby? So he came up with a Queen Alexandra nursing corps nurse and duly delivered the baby. And the fellow never did get his melons to market. And they thought we were bluffing to begin with when we said that nobody was going to move in and out until they'd taken down all the flags, painted out all the slogans. And we were told that if it took 9 months, they decided to make an issue of it. So on the fourth day, the Greeks really began to get the message when a whole lot of a unit of Royal Engineers turned up and started to dig a deep trench latrine. And I think in that moment it began to dawn on them that we really did mean that we were going to stay there. And on the fifth morning, lo and behold, lovely clean village, not a Greek flag in sight, not a slogan in sight. We packed up and went home.
So in the end, it turned out successfully in the end. Well, but you, from the sound of it, you feel better to have just ignored the flags and the original procession.
Yep.
A lot cheaper and easier.
If we had continued to sit in that orange grove, they would have marched down the road to the church, they would have held their church service, they'd have marched back to the square and they'd have all gone off to lunch.
They wouldn't have triggered the riot just anyway.
No, don't think so. I'm quite convinced they would have had their profession, waved the flag, and all gone off to a jolly good lunch.
And again, what does occur is the violence is low-level violence. It's not, they're not shooting or stabbing or isolating and killing British troops. They're just throwing stones.
But the major violence, of course, came much more in the shape of landmines, mining roads, ambushes. You're patrolling along the road, and a set ambush in a well-chosen site.
You weren't involved in that sort of thing. Were they frequent?
Oh, yes. Frequent enough to very much keep you on your on the alert. you couldn't relax. But, of course, at this time now, Yoker were fairly... were very much on the back foot at this time. Harding had been there. He'd been governor for... there were something like 30,000 soldiers seriously working at it. And so Ioka were very much on the back foot and neutralised at this time.
Did you have a... I mean, I'm sure you didn't meet him, but did you have an opinion of Harding, Field Marshal Harding?
I actually personally met him. My photograph appeared on the front page of the Cyprus Times talking to him. He came and visited our mess. And the first thing that amazed me was he's quite a small man. But, I mean, I only spoke to him, I don't know.
What impression did you make? Because we actually interviewed Harding about his time in Cyprus. And, What impression did he give you as a directing hand behind operations?
Deeply affected. He was sent out as governor, and as I understand it, his instructions were to restore peace to the island and neutralize Eoka, and he did that. And when we got there, as I say, Eoka was very much on the back foot, and come that autumn, apart from that Oki Day, and I'm not sure that Harding hadn't come by then. Eoka were very, 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 very relatively inactive. And of course, what happened then is Harding comes back, comes home. Out comes Sir Hugh Foote, great sort of liberal, you know, gallops about on a horse and eats breakfast under the palm tree with the locals. And 3 months later, the whole thing explodes twice as bad.
So you think that Harding's methods were effective in comparison?
Oh, yeah. But of course, it could not be a long-term solution. One has to be realistic. he pushed Eoka to the point where they could hardly operate. But it took him 30,000 troops, intensely working at it. Now that was not something that could go on forever. And what, as I understand it, what he said was basically to the government, "I've done my job. I've neutralized Eoka to the point where they're hardly at the moment operating. I can do no more. Now you've got to send somebody else out to try and find the long-term solution." and that was Foote. And I'm a little bit hard on him, but I mean, he had an impossible job. But he tried then to be conciliatory. He tried to negotiate.
I mean, Harding, we asked him.
Eased off all the military. Started pulling all the military back, so to speak. Eoka regroup, and then off they go again. But what did Harding say then?
he was asked, as I'll ask you, I mean, what he thought of being called Hangman Harding, you know, because he did pick up a reputation as a
hard man.
A hard man.
Oh, yeah.
And a hangman. I mean, he did hang some of the leaders. Did you have any opinion at the time? Not so much now, it's too long ago. But, I mean, at the time, what did you think of his...
Well, he was there only for such a short time, you see. I mean, I got there in the June, and my guess is Harding was gone by the September, I would think. I may be a little bit out on that. So, I mean, all I can say is, when we got there in the June, very intensive soldiering, in the sense for, I mean, all this patrolling, that is all part of the general suppressing of Eoka. And I, as I say, was not subjected to anything all that much, because by then Eoka were almost at standstill.